The message you are about to hear is brought to you by Art Bradick. And now, Mr. Bradick.
I want to get serious today, and thank you for attending with us, but I want to talk about something that is a serious issue and a serious problem in the Church of God. I don't know if many of you remember an incident that was titled in Time, Rathergate. Did you ever hear about Rathergate? Yeah, it was. You'll remember when I talk about it. It was September 2, 2004, just before the presidential election, and Dan Rather did a news story on 60 Minutes, and it was about six Killian documents, and these were unique documents. They were extremely critical of President then George W. Bush. And they were lies about his service when he was in the National Guard. Now, these documents were not documented. They weren't proven to be true or not by CBS. But they were later shown to be absolute forgeries. And they were just created by someone's computer and their anger and hostility towards the then president. And Dan Rather, though, continued, even knowing this, he continued in his story. He would stand by it. In subsequent interviews, he said this: even if the documents were false, the story he knew was actually true. And so he believed this in spite of any evidence to the contrary. You know, the point is, to me, how horrible it is to use false evidence to convince others. You know, a conviction can be strong enough, but you understand the conviction a person has can be strong enough to actually believe that the end justifies the means. And that's what happened in Rathergate. And so there's been a number of studies that have been done. Been a number of evidences and research that have been done on this subject, and all of them have discovered this one single vital truth, and that is those who are sincerely and deeply and powerfully convinced of their rightness are fully capable, almost armed, you might say, like a cocked gun, to do evil. They become so convinced that they are right that whatever they do, they think has to be good as a result. And so we saw on the news where Jimmy Swaggart, he told the whole audience and the whole world, and he told the prostitute that what he was doing was okay because he was God's man and it didn't matter. And so he needed to do this, and God let him go. Jim Jones in Guyana killed almost 400 people, and he started believing that he was right and that he was doing good. There was a shooting in Michigan in which a man just burst into a congregation, and he shot the pastor and his wife and some others before he was stopped. David Koresh killed many, many more, believing that what he was doing was right, but the end result was the death of dozens and dozens. And when I remember about it, I think about when I studied in college about the Crusades and how they went down to destroy the Muslims. And there were two accounts that were just shocking to me, and one was where they hit our people, the Albigenses, and they went into a church, and they killed every single man, woman, and child, and then they burned them on a great funeral pyre, and then they went ahead and ate dinner right afterwards in their sense of piety and righteousness for what they had done. And later I read another account where the Crusaders went down into Jerusalem, and they began to slaughter the Muslims down there, and they were saying how that the blood was running ankle deep They were sloshing around in their blood, and they were mocking them because they were trying to hide their gold by swallowing it. And the man writing the story was so proud to say, but they couldn't fool us, and so we just burned them until the gold melted out and ran in the streets and we got it. But you understand my point today is they were doing this thinking they were doing good, thinking that they were right and the other person was wrong. You know, that's what motivated them. Let's go to Psalm 14, if you will. You know, every one of us have probably come in contact with or experienced a case where people were self-righteous. You know, and if we're honest with ourselves, we might even agree that there's been times in your life and times in my life where you and I felt that we were righteous, you know, and it could be occasionally, but it can also become frequently. And in some groups today in the Church of God, it's become almost what we would call normal. And in other places, it's even encouraged to be self-righteous. It can be heady. It can really be a feeling that we feel inside us. It's seductive, and it can become addictive to people, the feeling of self-righteousness. You know, any honest person will agree that it feels good to feel that you are right. You know, it pulls on our carnal nature. We're right, and the other person is somehow terribly wrong. It can feel so intense sometimes humanly that it starts to feel delicious to our human nature. And people will go ahead and they'll seek to return to that feeling again and again. And it leaves its mark on every ideology. I remember I was reading an article this week, and it was just unbelievable how clear it was that the individual was talking about how religious people are the worst, they believe, when it comes to being self-righteous, and that's what many of the people out there that believe. But then there's the rationalists, and then there's the atheists, and he was saying how he's been in those groups, and he says they even have their own self-righteousness where they think, I'm better reasoned than others. You know, I'm more adamant and I have more proof, you know, that there is no God. And these people become self-righteous themselves, and they write books and they write articles, and they're condemning others for self-righteousness in the religious community while they are just as self-righteous themselves. And it was an admission from a man who was a part of their party, as it were. So anyway, this idea of feeling superior to others is and can be so dangerous, you know. Remember how the scriptures say, where do wars come from among us? They come from the lusts that dwell in us. And what is that lust? It's the lust to have more, to be greater than others. That's what we're facing today. And as a result, we're watching ourselves in the midst of what I call church wars. That is, other churches are condemning other brethren. They're saying that they're wrong, and they're saying that they're the only ones that are right. You know, we want to appear, it seems, more righteous than the other one. And the shocking truth is, in the end of the age, the churches of God are fighting one another. The churches of God are fighting one another, each thinking that they're superior than the other one. You know, and so we judge and we condemn others. And some leaders say they're the only ones that God is using. Every other one is wrong. They teach that they are somebody of great importance, and they'll condemn those who don't validate their belief. And it all starts with having the same goal. Every one of us, we strive, it says, you know, to seek after the kingdom of God first and to seek his righteousness. And so every one of us have this as a goal, seeking righteousness. And this is a noble end. It really is a noble end. But the problem is that in the process, we can start to become self-righteous. And to me, this age that you and I live in today is and does have a core of this issue of self-righteousness. And there is a problem with this. And you know what the problem is? The problem is the self. It's the self part. we dream it up ourselves. You know, holding a strong moral position, teaching a strong moral position, that's not wrong in itself. It's not wrong even if it irritates others. Because remember, the apostles preached the truth about Christ, and they were irritating the Pharisees to no end. But they were doing the right thing, and it's okay to have high moral standards. The issue is condemning others who are of the same belief or of the same faith, you know. And so there's nothing wrong with holding a strong view. But the problem is this. If we hold a strong view and we begin to look down at others because they aren't on our page, they haven't risen to our level, whatever we think that is, you know, we then look down on them and count them as less than us. And I'm saying this, that this is a malaise that has entered the Church of God, and it's poisoning us to a large degree. We live in what the Bible calls the last era of the Church of God. And in that last era, the people in it, they think they're in need of nothing. They think that they're okay the way they are. And they must then, by virtue of thinking that they're okay, must think that others aren't. And don't you see that how we fit this ideally? We fit this mold, we fit this picture. If we're acting self-righteous, if we're looking down on others because they don't believe like we do. And I remember early on we came out with this booklet, the Sabbath Test. And it's a truth. There's no question it's a truth. But I remember seeing the damage that it seemed to be causing because people were getting on the internet and condemning others. And I even got a letter from a minister in somewhere else in the United States, and he was writing me and he was saying, call off your dogs. There were people coming into his congregation in the middle of a Bible study and disrupting it and saying, why aren't you teaching this? You understand? People started thinking they were superior because they knew some doctrine somebody else didn't know. It's just plain and simple self-righteousness, and something that God, we'll see later, deeply, deeply condemns, believing that we're righteous. And what happens is we become smug and we become intolerant of other people, and we start raising ourselves, and they even get to some churches have a kind of policy in which, you know, it really doesn't matter if you have a question because you can always go to the person who always has the right answer. That's the leader. And you can't challenge that right answer because to do so is going against authority, going against God even. I remember a minister who was arguing with a man, and he says, well, you know, the man said, well, I'm not arguing against, you know, with you. I don't mean to do that, you know. I don't agree with your decision. You know what the minister said? You're not arguing with me. You're arguing with God. Who did he think he was? You understand my point? He started elevating his thoughts to a point where he thought he was right and everyone else was wrong. And when you get like that, other people challenging you or having a different thought is reprehensible, and you even get to thinking that it's vile sometimes. And sometimes it's punished in churches across our land. There's a man named Barna. He did a study in which he went around and he asked various people how they could define Christ. They wanted one word that could define him. And the response was compassionate, graceful, and humble, and wise. Then he asked them, would you define in one word a member of a Christian church? And here's what he found. They said critical, exclusive, self-righteous, and repressive. And that's what he found in the majority of cases across the land. And we all soon forget what I believe is this vital truth I'm going to quote right now. Mignon McLaughlin once said this, we are all irritated by rascals in life. And we're all intolerant of people that are absolute fools. However, we're prepared to love all the rest. But then he asks the question, where are the rest? You understand? We're all sinners. Every one of us are sinners. And so in Psalm 14, a familiar scripture here, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. They're corrupt. They've done abominable works, and there's none that does good. The Lord looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand and see God. And he said, they're all gone aside. They're altogether become filthy. There's none that does good, not one. You know, and we sometimes, we know the verse, we understand the verse, and yet we get ourselves caught up in thinking we are something, when the fact is, all of us are nothing, and we're less than nothing without God, is the truth. Remember the quote in Romans, quote of the Apostle Paul, all have sinned and come short of the glory of God. I'm sure he's referring to this chapter. The only value you and I have is that of Christ living in us, and it's his righteousness that makes us of any value. But any human things that we do are generally not of any real value. You know, his righteousness is based on love. Love towards God and love towards neighbor. And that's the righteousness he gives us in those Ten Commandments that are so valuable. But we humans, you know what we do? We create counterfeit laws that we live by. And those counterfeit laws, rather than his laws, become our standard for righteousness. And so it's interesting in that context to think about this issue of church eras, because we live in the last era of the New Testament eras, but there were Old Testament eras as well. And those Old Testament eras match perfectly with those in the New. Each one was just like, in a physical way that the spiritual church is down through the ages. And the Old Testament really, I think, gave us a good example of what we're like, because of the last era. The last era of the Old Testament was that of the Pharisees. Let's go to Romans 10. The last era of the Old Testament was the Pharisees. And we have, and we live by, aspects of their failed religion. You know, this was the issue that they had. Read this in Romans 10 in verse 3. For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, they went about to establish their own righteousness, self-righteousness, and they have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God. Back to Mark 7, if you will. Mark 7. They established, these individuals established their own religion, and that's something I think we need to realize. There's a lot of people that want to become messianics today, but they don't realize that the messianics are heavily into Judaism, and they think that Judaism is closer to God, but Judaism is a religion that the Jews actually made for themselves. They made it up themselves. And it was their religion. It was not God's religion at all. It's not closer to God. So they established their own righteousness. That's what they did. They made their own set of rules. They lived by those rules. How far you washed up to your arm, you know, how you, what kinds of prayers you said, how you said them, the things they did in the marketplace that we've read about and we'll probably read about later. All of those things were their criteria for righteousness, and they made their own religion out of it, out of this. And so it says, again, people think that it says in Mark 7 what the issue was. But many days today, people think that the Pharisees were very strict in keeping God's law, but that is not the truth at all. They were very strict in keeping their traditions, and by doing so, they avoided keeping God's law, and that's the problem that these people had. So in Mark 7 and verse 7, it says this, "Howbeit, in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men." And so they weren't keeping God's commandments strictly. They were keeping commandments of men. How? For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men, such as the washing of pots and cups and many other things like you do. So here you go. You can do your dishes and make your dishes sparkling white and clean, and yet we, the ones who eat off those dishes, are still dirty inside. You understand my point? Because of self-righteousness. And this is what I believe the last era has becoming more and more like, more and more moving in that direction. They ignore God's commandments in many cases, and they do so in order to keep their own traditions. And this is the direction we're going in. Paul Harvey once said this: too many Christians are no longer fishers of men, but they're keepers of the aquarium. That is, they have all their rules for how the aquarium is to be settled out and how there's no waves in the aquarium. That's how we're starting to move, and that's how we are in many churches today. I remember when I took over a number of churches in a different group I was with at one time, and I had several churches, and as I traveled up and down California, I remember finding out I was easy to talk to, but I found out there were all kinds of problems, but the ministers that were there before me didn't want to hear those problems. So everybody's talking to me about them, but the reason was all they wanted was smooth sailing. They didn't want to hear any waves. They didn't want to have to fix or deal with any problems. They just wanted everyone to act like they were all righteous. That's what they promoted in those congregations. And so what happens is we as human beings make up our own criteria for what is righteousness. And I remember talking to Judy for a while, and she was telling me about the Seventh-day Adventists that, you know, they advocate vegetarianism. And this is a big thing. If you follow Ellen G. White and you keep the vegan lifestyle, you are righteous. And she was talking about once going with a group of people, and there was a lady who was one of her associates at Seventh-day Adventist, and right in the middle of the group she said, you know, I don't eat any meat. And she wanted to make sure everyone heard that, because that was her sign of righteousness. But it's not that different, because I was with a group of people once, and we were at a restaurant, and the man was almost yelling as he told the waitress, I don't eat any pork. Is there pork in this soup? You know, wants everyone to know he doesn't eat pork. Well, there you go. Aren't you righteous? You know, doing what God says to do. It's so funny. Pentecostals are noted for their righteousness. It's really easy. It's obvious to them. They have a way, they have a criteria of telling if you're righteous. That is, you have to speak in tongues. And they have absolute proof that God's working with you and that you're righteous. And so the more you speak in tongues, the more close to God you are, the more righteous you are. You know, in the Amish community, did you know this? You can't own an automobile. You can use one. You can pay somebody to use one, but you can't own it because that is a taboo. You understand? So you have to have a horse and buggy, and that proves your identity is Amish. And that's one of their highest standards to them of doing what is right. And it's so funny in all these different churches that we have these rules, you know, and that we follow so many of them. You know, today it's being in the right church. When my daughter was going to Ambassador College and the breakup of Worldwide began to happen, one of her roommates was screaming at her, just screaming at her, I'll show you, you'll see who's in the right church when you're in the tribulation and I'm not. What? That's no way to even talk to a Christian, is it? It's so wild. I can't believe it sometimes that I've seen. You know, some people believe that having more knowledge is important, and they have certain knowledge of prophecies, and it makes them feel superior to others. It can be having the right date for the calendar to some. To others, it's saying God's name in exactly a certain way, and that gives you a righteousness. It's a step above somebody else. More and more, you know, it's happening that people right now, there's two groups that have projects underway to make Ambassador College look-alike campuses. They're trying to build these very beautiful places that makes them look more like Worldwide, and this is, to them, a righteous thing to do. And I think, you know, in a falling economy, is we should be spending that money on preaching the gospel, but that's my opinion. But they're still doing this because it's the outside look that matters so much, not the inside of the person, but the outside look. That proves that their work is the right one. You know, others believe that it's publishing more booklets than anybody else, and some others believe it's your hair length, and others believe it's skirt length. But we have all, you understand, all these counterfeit rules that show our righteousness, not living God's way. And so this is why I'm addressing this today. I remember I went to Ambassador College, and I was taught there by the one who managed the auditorium, and it was such a beautiful place, but he managed the ushers and everything, and he gave us classes. And we learned that we were to read this book, Dress for Success, and we were to understand that there was only one acceptable way to dress, and that was two plain, one fancy. So you could have your suit was plain, your shirt was plain, but you could have a fancy tie. But if you had a fancy shirt, you had to have a plain tie. And we had all these rules. And if you carried a briefcase that was black, that was out, man. It had to be burgundy or it could be brown. You understand? And it had to be this to look. You had to have a power tie. We had to learn what a power tie really was, and we had to carry briefcases that were a certain color, and all these gave us the image of somebody who really was with it, somebody who was really successful. And here's my point about all of this. I ask us today to think about this. Is it possible for the church to sit and grow in a culture long enough that after a while they start accepting the culture's values rather than the values of God? Because he makes a pretty profound statement about somebody with nice clothes condemning others that don't have nice clothes in James, and the ones that have more money being considered more important and better and more righteous and having special seats. And wow, does that ever happen? When I was an usher, at Ambassador College, I remember just before when I started school there, I sat down in this section and somebody came to me and said, "You can't sit here." I said, "I can't sit here?" And they said, "No, this is reserved for the ministry. Only the ministry could sit in this one section because they were the special ones. They were the elite. They were superior to everybody else." And I'm saying today, this kind of thinking is what's put us in the position we're in today, where we're fighting each other for who is more important, who is more righteous, who is better than anyone else. So you get the point, I'm sure. We're not the judges on these things. None of this stuff is righteous. None of it matters at all. This is a vital, important point, I think, to consider. I remember once, it was so funny, I was early in the church and I was all excited about the truth. I listened to what just about everybody said, but we were out playing baseball one day and we were walking by this fence and this fellow told me, he said he didn't think that anybody in the church could ever be a Democrat. You know, what are you judging by? What is your code that you're going by? Is it God's? Or is it somebody else's? Or is it your own? Is it just made up out of nothing? Matthew 23. Because the end time age is very much like the Pharisees. And we need to look at them, I think. Because they made up their own rules. And they condemned others based on those rules that they made up. And Christ condemned their practices. He said this, saying that the scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore, whatever they bid you to do, observe, and observe and do that. That's fine. Do what your leaders say, but don't do after their works, because the truth is they say as they read the scriptures, but they don't actually do it. And that is so true. They taught the law of God to the people, and that was their job to do on a local level. However, they didn't live by the way they taught. They thought they were different. They thought they were superior to the others, and so these rules that they taught didn't apply to them. And so what did they do? They bound, in verse 4, heavy burdens that were grievous to be borne, and they lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves wouldn't move with one of their fingers, they wouldn't remove them. So they weren't seeking the righteousness of God, but they were seeking the righteousness that appeared in the eyes of other men. In verse 5, but all their works they do to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. And so everything became a show. I remember once I was leading songs and I introduced a guy for prayer, and he came up and he had it all written out. Why, what did you think he cared about? Talking to God or making sure he looked good to the congregation? You understand, this whole issue of how we appear to others is almost always wrong, because we aren't to judge how others are by what they appear to be. It's Christ's righteousness that really matters. And they love the uppermost rooms at the feasts and the chief seats in the synagogue, a whole section just for ministers alone. And they kicked me out. And they love greetings in the marketplaces and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. And so it is. He says this, don't be called Rabbi, for only one is your master, even Christ, and you are all brethren. Don't you wish we understood this? Don't you wish that we understood? I mean, I consider other people our brethren, but there's many that would never consider us as brethren. They just wouldn't do it because we're somehow beneath them, because we're not doing what they're doing and we're not a part of their group. This is so tragic. Ministers today often have titles, as a matter of fact, that they are so proud of. I remember there was a time where Mr. Armstrong got upset with some of the ministers, and he told them that had doctorate degrees, he said, I don't want you to call yourself doctors. He said, that's just a human title. It has no value, and it's only designed to impress others. And so a minister who was an evangelist gave us a very powerful sermon, and he told us never again to ever call him doctor. And then when Worldwide finally fell apart, he changed that back again. In fact, it was really interesting. I was in a congregation that he would come up and visit from time to time, but we had four people in there that had PhD degrees. And, of course, somebody said that was piled higher and deeper. But the point I'm making is that in every case, if you said Mr. So-and-so to them, they would soon correct you and say, I'm Dr. So-and-so. And why would they care about that? It's because they're elevating themselves above everybody else, whatever degree you might have or not have. And none of that means anything, nothing to God. If we act according to how he tells us to act, that means a great deal to him. And so anyway, some of the most, I think, obvious here is this one. Call no man your father upon earth, for one is your father, and neither be called masters, for one is your master, even Christ. But he that is greatest among you shall be as your servant. And whoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he that shall humble himself shall be exalted. Do we get that message? I mean, do we really see that the reverse is true? If we exalt ourselves in any of these ways, making sure everybody calls us by some title like doctor or whatever, that this is going to be important? I mean, the Pope today calls himself Father, in direct contradiction to this, and people come up and kiss, the statue there until they've worn his toe away, you know, giving him enormous reverence to a man. And it's just so wrong. But the Protestants think we'd never do that, but they call themselves Reverend, which is God's name. Holy and Reverend is his name, not their name. And so some will take it a step better than that. I remember reading a book once. I was looking through it, perusing it, and the guy who had written it was called himself the Most Right Reverend. Can you imagine that? That would be almost totally embarrassing to have that written on one of your books. So, you know, in the Church of God, are we any different than that, in all honesty? I remember I talked to one man, and he said to me as he barked, because I took some directions from somebody else when I was in college who was over a certain department, and regarding that department, I took his directions, and the other this fellow told me that he was the highest-ranking evangelist in the Church of God, and he was furious with me for not taking his directions. And so it is. Another calls himself today an apostle. One goes so far as to say that he is that prophet, and that prophet refers to Christ, and that was the words Moses used. One man who said he was one of the two witnesses just went to jail for fraud. But you get my point. It's all ridiculous. It's all really ridiculous. These titles may make us feel more righteous, but they don't make us any more righteous. And I ask you, just think of it from God's perspective. Imagine him looking down here and seeing us calling ourselves something important. I mean, I'm the most important ant around here. I'm the big top dog grasshopper, right? You understand? We're nothing. Nothing compared to him. Can you create a universe? Anybody here? You know, anybody in the Church of God, can you do that? You know, would you come down and let yourself be beaten beyond recognition? Would you do that because you loved everybody? You know, what kind of people are we, and what kind of people are we really becoming? You know, I hope you can see what I'm saying here. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You devour widows' houses in verse 14, and for a pretense you make long prayers. Therefore, you shall receive the greater condemnation. You know, we don't do that today, I don't think. I mean, sometimes prayers get a little bit long, but we don't really go about doing it like this. But what we do is send out letters to people, and it's happened where groups, I know of two groups so far, that have asked their members to mortgage their house and send the money to them. One was because of terrible financial mistakes that one individual made, and I was part of the group warning him not to make those mistakes, but he did it anyway, and then he asked people to mortgage their homes. Another one, of course, has a big building project going now, and he told people it was a sign of their faith if they sent in money from mortgaging their house and sent it to him. I just can't imagine this, but don't they ever read this? You take widows' houses, you take other people's property, you know, for what reason? To make yourself better off? Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, in verse 15, hypocrites, you compass the sea and land to make one proselyte, and when he's made, you make him twofold the child of hell. Twofold the child of hell than yourselves. And so we all like that, don't we? I remember I was in a group once, and the people were saying, well, I wish, you know, more people would come. I wish we'd get more people. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you want that for? And he says, well, it kind of validates what we're doing. And I'm thinking, yes, that's the point. You know, do we want to make a proselyte? Do we want a convert so that we can help somebody see the greatness and the goodness and the kindness and the beauty and the majesty of God who created us? Or do we want to make a proselyte so that it validates us? Because now you're one of us. And then what do? Once we make them one of us, we give them our counterfeit rules to judge by, and then we make it worse on him. We make him like ourselves with self-righteousness. And so that's what I'm after today. That's what I'm trying to talk about. We've got to avoid these kinds of things, doing it in our life. So can you imagine God needing anybody's money? If God were really behind a work, would somebody have to ask people to mortgage their homes? Does that make any sense at all when he owns all the gold and all the silver are his and he could just make it miraculously appear? He made it come into a fish's mouth, you know, to pay money. You know, if he wants us to have it, we'll have it. It's ridiculous to think any other way. So anyway, woe to you blind guides, he says. Woe to you blind guides wanting to validate yourself, which say, whoever shall swear by the temple, it's nothing, but whosoever shall swear by the gold of the temple, he's the debtor. And so the money we have in the church is really a sign of how righteous we are, aren't we? One person said, the growth, that's a sign of our righteousness and approval from God. Well, then the Catholic Church has more people than any of us. They're the ones that we should follow, and if that's really the case, you know. And so money is what we care about. Look at what he says. I mean, this is like scary language, you know. You fools and blind, For what's greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it's nothing. But whosoever swears by the gift that is upon it, he's guilty. And here it is again. You fools and blind, for what's greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Whoso, therefore, shall swear by the altar, swears by it and all the things thereon. And whosoever shall swear by the temple, swears by it and by him that dwells therein. And he that swears by heaven, swears by the throne of God and by him that sits thereon. And I'd ask anybody to just read Revelation 4 and look at that throne and the majesty and the glory and the might and the power that emits from it as millions of angels come from all over the universe to bring their problems and ask for advice and ask for judgments from the great King of the universe. Man, that is a frightening place to be. And when John saw it, he fell down as if he was dead. And sometimes I think he may have died and the angel raised him up. You understand my point. This is the way God is. Well, how do we compare in our best suits and our best briefcase and our wingtip shoes? And how do we compare to him? It's just silly to think about it, you know. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites. You pay tithe of mint and anise and cumin have omitted the weightier matters of the law, judgment, mercy, and faith. Well, yes, these you ought to have done, but you shouldn't leave the other undone. And that's so true for all of us. You and I, in this world, in our churches that we go to, they care so much about the tithes and so much about the offerings, so much about the buildings and where they have their headquarters and so on. We care more about the numbers of people in our churches than we care about the individuals in the church. That's what happens. They go unnoticed. There was one man that was in a church I heard in California recently. He didn't show up for a while. They didn't find him. He had been dead for 3 weeks. But I bet you all those 3 weeks he was probably counted as a member when it comes to handing in the sheep, because you want all the numbers you can get, because that shows you're doing a good job for God, I guess. The bigger we are, the more validated we feel. And what we should be doing is building. There's no question that we should be building. But what we should be striving to do is build the character of Christ and the image of Christ in every single individual to the best of our ability. And what we build of steel and what we build of wood, it has absolutely no meaning in the end. It's all going to be burned up, and God calls it chaff. And he tells us to build gold and to build silver. And so there we are. We're measuring righteousness by skirt length. You know, you have to bow down, get on your knees, and your skirt has to touch the floor, or else you can't attend church. And we measure it by hair lengths, and we measure it by church attendance, and we gauge righteousness by the amount of literature we produce, number of TV programs we're on, by the number of hits we get on our computers, or our websites, rather. And so that's what we're doing. We're making counterfeit rules, and we judge by those rules how we stand with God instead of going by his rules. And so we have all these issues that we do, like measuring the new moon and getting it just right. I mean, there's 3, 4, 5, 6 different ways to measure that, and nowhere in the Bible does it say it all. You know, judging by how we say God's name just right is just so bizarre to me when no one knows how to say it, and yet you do, and so you're special, you're unique. You know, all of this is just plain selfishness. It's self-centeredness and self-righteousness. And we've got to get the point that Christ is making here. And this is what he says. You blind guides. Man, I know I am sometimes. Here I am a guide, and I'm blind myself. I don't even see what I'm doing sometimes. We strain at a gnat, and we swallow a camel. That is, we do all these things, minutia that we are so rigid in, and yet at the same time, we let the major things slide by that are important to God's law. "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, you're hypocrites! For you may clean the outside of the cup and the platter, but within they're full of extortion and excess." And that is so true. We know how to dress. We know how to act in church. We got all the manners down. But you blind Pharisees, cleanse first that which is within the cup and the platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites! You're like whited sepulchres, which indeed appear beautiful outwardly, but within you're full of dead men's bones and all uncleanness. That scares the living daylights out of me, doesn't it, you? Can you imagine that? Looking good at church, you know, being someone that speaks, someone that closes and opens with prayer, somebody that the others think is somebody in the church. But there's invisible people in the church. There's widows. There's elderly people that are praying their hearts out and that are giving themselves to God in their lives. And that's who he's counting. He's not counting the ones that have it outside. He's not looking at that. Even so, you also outwardly appear righteous unto men, but within you're full of hypocrisy and full of iniquity. Think about it. Couldn't this be one of the single most important lessons in life itself? Couldn't it be? I mean, right now in our age and the time we live in, couldn't this be more important than we've really thought about it? Looking as though we're righteous to other men is so incredibly shallow. It really is. Humanly, we can set up hundreds, if we want, of criteria for being righteous instead of what God is saying. But true righteousness is defined, but only defined, by God himself. And he's given it to us in his law. Self-righteousness is that which is defined by man. And we seldom believe wrongs could ever be done by nice people like us. Isn't that true? I remember one minister gave a sermon. He said, "I hadn't sinned an important sin in 40 years. And I went, "Man, oh man, that's because your sins aren't important to you. They're just little, whatever they are, because you're you and you're important and you're a good man." But you know, the point I'm making today is every one of us feels the same way. Every one of us thinks that the things we do can't be wrong because we're the ones doing them. You know, we don't see what we do often, and we don't count it as wicked and evil as we should because of our self-righteousness. We're all good people. Paul knew a lot better. He said he didn't even judge himself, is what he said, and we should not either. We shouldn't rate ourselves and put ourselves up or put ourselves down. He says, "Who can know their own sins?" He says, "The heart is deceitful and wicked. Who can know it?" Well, you can't know it unless you're really ready to challenge yourself and go inside and look at yourself and see what we look like. Let's go over to Luke 8. Luke 8. There's a vital reason why this occurs and why we think this way. That man didn't think his sins were important. We all fall prey to it from time to time. We automatically minimize our sins and we magnify the sins of others. And so in that respect, Christ gave us, I'm sorry, I wanted to go to Luke 18, but he gave us an example here, and it starts in verse 9. "And he spoke this parable unto certain which trusted in themselves that they were righteous, and they despised others. And he said, 2 men went up into the temple to pray, the one a Pharisee and the other a publican." And so have we ever witnessed this kind of behavior, people thinking they're superior to others and condemning others because they're not like them? I think it's really funny. Josh Billings made a comment once, and he said, I never have any trouble in regulating my own conduct, but to keep other folks straight, that's what bothers me. Yeah. Well said, Josh. Anyway, there's only two kinds of men, and one kind of man is the righteous man who thinks he's a sinner. The other one is a sinner who thinks he's righteous. And so our Savior goes on to demonstrate or show the difference in these two attitudes. In verse 10, two men went into the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other publican. From all outward measures, they looked the same, and they were going to the same place, and they were going to do the same thing. But then look at the difference. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, extortioners, unjust, adulterers, or even as this publican here. I fast twice in the week. I give tithes to all that I possess, of all that I possess. Now he contrasts it with the publican. The publican, standing far off, would not lift up so much as his eyes to heaven, but smote on his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. And then he tells us something, and he's telling this to you right now, and he's telling it to me. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone that exalts himself shall be abased, and he that humbles himself shall be exalted. And so do we understand what we just read? Any one of us that is exalting ourselves and thinking we are something, we are dooming ourselves to being abased. And it's going to be a real rough abasement. So we need to give this some thought about what do we want out of life and what are we doing with the life that we have here. You know, self-righteousness is pretty easy to spot. And the reason is because, if you'll go over to Matthew 6, by the way, Matthew 6, it's very easy to spot self-righteousness because it always demands external rewards of some kind. That is, the people that are really self-righteous need to get feedback and know that people see them, that people appreciate them, they get their recognition needs met somehow, and they're looking for human approval while seeming religious and seeming modest, and they'll do this. But they're always concerned with the visible results. They look to see if their service is going to be recognized. And our flesh, it's crying out for recognition. We want to be noticed. We want to be special in one way or another. And so we devise these various subtle means for calling attention to ourselves. But I want you to consider Christ's words here in Matthew 6. Matthew 6 and verse 1. He says this, take heed to yourselves that you don't do your alms before men to be seen of them. Otherwise, you have no reward of your Father in heaven. So you can give away your mortgage. You can give away all you have. You can throw in the greatest amount of money. But you got your reward. If you're showing it off, you've got it already. So you don't get it in the kingdom of God. Therefore, when you do your alms, don't sound a trumpet before you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets. They may have the glory of men. Truly, I say unto you, they have their reward. I remember we used to meet at the Jewish center. And it was really interesting to me how they put everybody's name that made a big donation on the front seats. And so you'd sit in the chair and it would have some family's name on it. And they were the ones that had contributed the most. And that was their seat. And only they could sit in that seat. And it's very similar to me. Truly I say unto you, they have their reward. But when you do your alms, don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing, you know. That your alms may be in secret, and your Father which sees in secret, he promises to reward you openly. And then when you pray, you shall not be as the hypocrites are. They love to pray standing in the synagogues and in the corners of the street that they can be seen of men. Truly I say to you, they have their reward. Down on Main Street now, and Wicks Avenue, they have people that go out there and they have megaphones and they have their Bibles and they're holding them and showing them, and everybody knows they're righteous. And they have their kids and family there, and everybody can see that drives by they're righteous, but they don't know. Everybody thinks they're fools. Everybody thinks they're just fools. And so they are. But you, when you pray, enter your closet, and when you've shut the door, pray to your Father, which is in secret, and your Father, which sees in secret, shall reward you openly, and don't use vain repetitions, and so on. Don't be like them. Your Father knows what you need before you ask. And so we may really compromise our reward by drawing attention to ourselves. There was a TV program most of you know about, and it was called MASH, and there was Colonel Potter there, and he said something I thought was really interesting. He said, just remembering there's a right and a wrong way to do everything and a wrong way to do everything. So always remember there's a right way and a wrong way to do everything. And he says the problem is the wrong way is to keep trying to make everybody else do it the right way. So every one of us is trying to get everybody else to do it our way. But, you know, have you ever watched someone who's an avid football fan and they're watching the TV and they're watching the football game and their team is losing? And he is telling the quarterback, you should have done this. You should have done that. He's telling the receivers, you can't catch worth a darn. You know, you're just no good. You know, and he's telling the coaches what they should be doing and the plays they should be making. And he knows all about it. But, well, what, if he's that good and that smart, why is he sitting in that chair eating more, drinking his beer? Why isn't he out there playing? You understand? He doesn't really know. But look at what the mind does. I know better than them. I know better than these guys. That's their whole career. You understand? This is us. This is human nature. This is self-righteousness raising its head in us in different ways. It doesn't have to be right at church. It can be in all kinds of ways. And so Matthew 7 and verse 1, judge not. Don't condemn these other people when you don't know what you're doing, for with what judgment you judge, you'll be judged. And what measure you meet, it shall be measured to you again. Why do you behold the mote that's in your brother's eye, but consider not the beam that is in your own eye? And this is so funny. You know what a mote is? A mote is a speck of dust. You ever get a speck of dust in your eye and you kind of blink a little bit and it comes out? You know what a beam is? A beam is the great, big, massive timber, tree size, that holds the house up. Can you imagine a guy swinging around like this and everybody's ducking because he's got this big beam sticking out of his eye and he's, let me get that mote out of your eye for you, you know. I mean, it's almost ridiculous. Anybody that thinks that Christ doesn't have a sense of humor is missing the point here. This is funny. You know, it really is funny. How will you say to your brother, let me pull out the mote out from your own eye, and behold, a beam is in your own eye? You hypocrite, first cast the beam out of your own eye, then you'll see clearly, cast the mote out of your brother's eye. What good advice that is, isn't it? It really is. 1 Corinthians 4. 1 Corinthians 4, and we won't go too much longer than this. All of us have motes in our own eyes, just a speck of dust, you know. And all of us, I think, have, in one case or another, beams in our own eye that holds up the house. So all we have to do is consider how hard it is to change ourselves to think and understand how difficult it is to try to change somebody else. There's a quote I think is really good, and it comes from Huckleberry Finn, of all places. But he says, pretty soon I want to smoke. I asked the widow to let me, but she wouldn't. She said it was a mean practice, and it wasn't clean, and I must not try to ever do it again. And, of course, she took snuff, too. Of course, it was all right because she done it herself. Isn't that true? So true. We got a beam in our own eye, and we're judging everybody else. But Paul makes a interesting point. We all have some good qualities and some not so good qualities, but we tend to condemn the people that don't have the good qualities that we have. And so here he is defending himself, and he's defending Apollos to the Corinthian church because they have come under fire to the brethren. And the apostle wrote this, let no man so account us as of the ministers of Christ and stewards of the ministry of God. Account us, is what he's saying, to be ministers and stewards of God. Moreover, it's required in stewards that a man be found faithful. But with me, it's a very small thing that I should be judged of you or of a man's judgment. Yes, I judge not my own self. Can you imagine someone like sitting in their chair with their beer in their hand, and instead of judging football, they're judging the ministry and they're judging God's apostle? It's the same mentality. It's the same thing. For I know nothing of myself, he says, yet I am not hereby justified, But he that judges me is the Lord. In other words, I don't have to justify myself. He'll do it for me. Therefore, judge nothing before the time until the Lord comes, who will both bring to light the hidden things of darkness and make manifest the counsels of the hearts. And then shall every man have praise of God. Can't you see that? If we're not going around condemning other people, thinking we're better, if we just let him be the judge, that it's all going to come out eventually and we'll get the recognition, we will. If we aren't judging everybody and looking for recognition now, then we'll lose our recognition by him. And I think being recognized by him, being said, well done, thou good and faithful servant, there just can't be any better time in the world. And these things, brethren, I have figured in a figure transferred to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that you might learn in us not to think of men above that which is written, which that no one of you be puffed up against one another. That's us. That's us today. That's what's happening in the church of God. For who makes you to differ from another? And what do you have that you didn't receive? Have you ever thought about that? We all have good traits. We all have positive personality traits. We all have talents that other people don't have. But we think we're better than them because we have a talent they don't have. But they always have a talent we don't have. Who are we? We're nobody to do that. And every one of us, that we have a talent, where'd we get it? Did we make it? No. It just comes naturally. It's us, given to us freely from God. Now, if you did receive it, why do you glory as though you had not received it? Man, that is such an valuable point. Now you're full. Now you're rich. You've reigned as kings without us. And I would to God you did reign, and that you might reign, we might reign with you. For I think that God has set us as apostles last, as it were appointed to death, for we are made a spectacle unto the world, and to angels and men. We are fools for Christ's sake, but you are wise in Christ. We're weak, but you're strong. You're honorable, and we are despised. Can you imagine treating an apostle like that? We shouldn't treat anybody like that. Even under this present hour, we're both hunger, we thirst, we're naked and are buffeted and have no place to dwell. We labor working with our own hands, being reviled. We bless, being persecuted. We suffer for it. Being defamed, we entreat. We're made as filth of the world, and we're the offscouring of our all things to this day. Now, I don't write these things to shame you, but as my beloved sons and daughters, I'm writing this to warn you. This could happen to us. He's warning us. Don't let this happen to us. Philippians 2. And we'll go ahead and finish there. Philippians 2. God tells us this indisputable truth. Every man is right in his own eyes. It's so true, and it's so almost ironically funny. And he says the heart is wicked, deceitful, and that's another truth. And it's because we always see things from our own perspective, and our heart does not let us see the evil that is in ourselves. We have to force ourselves to examine ourselves. And so we focus on our good traits, and we don't focus on our bad traits. And so Paul has told us what I think is a fundamental and magnificent truth in life, but more important for this era we live in, the good qualities in us were not created by us. We should praise God for giving them to us, not condemn others. And the example we're to follow is that of Christ. And this is where the apostle writes some of the most beautiful words in this Bible. And he says, in chapter 2, verse 1, if there be any consolation in Christ, if there be any comfort of love, if there be any fellowship of the Spirit, if there be any bowels of mercy, fulfill you my joy, that you being like-minded, having the same love, and being of one accord and one mind. Oh, how I wish we were like that. Let nothing be done through strife or vainglory, but we're having everything done through strife and vainglory. But in lowliness of mind, let each esteem other better than themselves. Can't you imagine that? The leaders of the groups out there, esteeming the other one better. That would fix it all, wouldn't it? One sentence fixes all if we just follow it. look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. That is, what they need, what we can contribute and help. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God. You couldn't be higher. You couldn't be more superior. But he didn't think it was robbery to be equal with God. He made himself of no reputation, took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in the likeness and fashion of man, he humbled himself and he became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. Therefore God has highly exalted him and given him a name which is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in things of heaven and things in earth and things under the earth, and every tongue should confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of the Father. Wherefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but how much more in my absence, work out your own salvation. But how do we do that? With pride and vanity? With self-righteousness? How do we work out our own salvation? With fear and with trembling, humility. For it's God who works in you both to desire to do the good and the ability to do his good pleasure. Do everything without murmuring and without disputings, that you may be blameless and harmless, the sons of God without rebuke in the midst of a crooked and perverse nation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Wouldn't that be wonderful to have him think of us that way? That would be more than wonderful to be that way. So I'm asking us today, let's be aware of this trap, the trap of self-righteousness. And let's make sure that we watch our walk and that we don't fall into it. And let's kneel before God in prayer, realizing who it is we're kneeling before. Not doing it because we always kneel out of ritual, but kneel before God because of his greatness and his majesty. See how minuscule we are before him. And don't think that we're better than others. Don't boast ourselves, or don't compare ourselves with one another, but compare ourselves with him when we do so. And if we do this, you and I really can escape this malaise of self-righteousness and the end of the age. And we won't condemn others, and then we won't be condemned by him. But I want to